But it could mean it could
happen.
It could
happen, though. It could happen.
It could happen.
One in a million, could that happen?
Yeah.
It's unlikely.
But it could happen.
But it could happen. They almost are the same. I?
Has no quantity.
Would? Yeah. I would think not likely is one in a million in five hundred thousand. Unlikely at best is one in 500,000.
Okay, it's a little bit greater chance of that happening.
Twice as much.
But it A-L already has happened.
Yes, he's talked.
Yes. I am that. I am that good. Oh, now he's determined. That's the last syllable you're getting
out
of him.
Yeah, he wants to hear another word from him now.
I'll stay shut up that easily.
Maybe you should just hold the mic.
I've known him for 7 years. He just surprised the hell out of me.
Well, he thinks he's just getting warmed up. How? How did you meet you and Michael?
In a moment of in a moment of weakness. I was like perfectly content to not get in another relationship in my life. And I had
that they always say that.
Well, not that I wasn't gonna, you know, have fun, but I just wasn't gonna get in an involvement. And but we knew each other because mutual friends, we would go out to movies together. And I was at the Alameda County Fair when they had the shootout several years ago.
Yeah.
And I was there that day, and I had a movie date with Michael and our mutual friends the next day. So I was, like, really a mess. So I was really needy. And that's just kind of like, it just happened. He snuck in at a moment of a moment of neediness.
and E never looked back. Never L E left and never left.
He snuck in and never kicked left. Him out. Nope. We just kinda stayed together. Yeah. Yeah.
Where should where did you D U C C duck when the S shooting happened?
Well, I was really lucky in that I was there with a group of friends. Two of us had just left the main area to go out to get the blankets out of my car. And we were in the parking lot, the two of us, when it broke loose inside. All of a sudden, we saw all these people coming, jumping over the walls, screaming, everything. And we all had cell phones, so we were able to call our friends that were inside and find out, you know, that they were okay, but they were trying to find their way to us. And when we eventually all got into my car, we couldn't move. There were people standing on cars, throwing off fireworks and shooting guns. It was just, oh, it was one of the scariest experiences I ever had. We just all hunkered down in my Volkswagen van, you know, until we were able to slowly drive out of the place. We finally saw a like a truck delivery road, and we just blasted through a fence and went out that way and got out of it.
Wow. I always T-H thought I would S-L-I slide out of my chair in a situation like that.
Well, in the crowd, there was one person in a wheelchair that the crowd just bowled over and knocked his chair sideways and knocked him out of it. So there was, you know, the crowd inside was just going crazy because this guy was just shooting randomly into the crowd. So they were just scattering like scared cattle. And so, yeah, I was so lucky, my timing on that, to have been in the parking lot. But do you do, like I do, I always make a plan whenever I go anywhere, like, what's my escape plan here? Yeah.
Do you do that? No.
Huh?
Not really?
I just kind of do, you know, when I stay at a hotel, I know where the exit is, and I figure out, you know, what I do in the case of needing to get out.
H. E. Hey. M. Most of our gigs are upstairs. So we end up lugging, you know, we're carrying Frank up in his chair. I always figure if something happens when we're in that situation, we just, like, pick Frank up out of his chair and run. You know?
Yeah.
I figure there's probably, like adrenaline makes you a little bit stronger than you normally are, and you could just do what you maybe wouldn't normally
definitely
be inclined to do.
I figure if I was in a situation where I was upstairs like that, I would just slide on my chair and slide down the stairs on my butt, you know?
Yeah,
just get out of there.
Right, yeah.
When I ride BART sometimes, especially the tunnel, you know, sometimes the BART slows down in the tunnel. That's a little scary. So I kind of look around the room and I think, okay, if this became a situation that I needed help with,
who's the person?
Who in here do I think would be a good person to grab?
Yeah.
And I make sure I know where they are, just in case.
Yeah, yeah. Before C H A I chair S chairs H A had brakes. Yeah, Frank has a lot of horror stories.
Back
when the motor chairs didn't have brakes, and he'd go out. That's during the period when he was out by himself all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd go. I mean, he has stories of going down Knob Hill in San Francisco with no brakes. And, you know, where people would come up to him and say, can I please help you? They just couldn't stand it. Because, you know, if you hit a bump, and then, because they would do it with a pointer in that funky little cup. And, you know, it was always like getting knocked out. And then under stress, you know, it's like trying to get it back in the cup. And meanwhile, the chair is just like going. And he said a lot of times the way he would stop would be he'd just steer the chair into a parked car.
Oh, a parked car. Yeah. I was thinking a building, but yeah, a parked car is probably a little softer.
Yeah, and he said that he's mashed many a people in their, like, getting out of their car. I D R drove in the S T R street. You would drive in the street a lot.
Well, there's less bumps. And going up and down some of those curves where you're kind of double curved.
Yeah.
It slants this way and that way at the same time. Yeah. Yeah.
And they H A had 1, C, curb cut. Oh, I think things have gotten a lot better, but you'd get up on a curb cut, and then when you got to the end of that street, there wouldn't be a curb cut. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's better now, isn't it?
It is. That's kind of what it's going to be like in Davis for me, because I'm moving to Davis, and there are some places, and I'm plotting out. It's laid out, though, really well for bicycles, so a lot of times I just stay in the bike lane. I don't get up on the sidewalk at all.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's gotten much better. But it's still kind of lousy in San Francisco. You know, it's better over on the east side of the bay, I think.
Y, G, O, go to Davis.
Okay. You want the first answer I give everyone that asks me that? So I can have chickens. I want chickens. But also, I just feel like Berkeley's getting too big, too many people, too noisy, too much construction going on. And I'm a farm girl. And Michael grew up in Davis. He was born and grew up in Davis. And we've made like this long plan to move to Davis, and he's been living there for about a year and a half now, and I've been visiting him to see if I could get along with the climate and the environment and the pollens and all that. And I did good, so then I started looking for a place, and I move in 1 month.
Wow.
So, yeah.
You R F R O, from, N, E, where are you from?
Nebraska.
Ah.
The second worst state in the union to be from.
What's the first worst?
Kansas.
H, hey, at least it is F, L, flat, Nebraska.
Oh, yeah. Flat, flat, flat. And cold, cold, cold. Yeah. So, but Davis is pretty flat. Yeah. And the place I'm moving into? Chickens. I got chickens.
You've got.
I actually found a place with chickens. Yeah.
Oh, it comes with the place. The
well, yeah, yep. Can't have a cat or a dog, but I got chickens. It's actually a co-housing project where a lot of people that knew each other have slowly bought all the houses on the block, and then they tore down all the backyard fences,
and
they've built a community garden and a playground and chickens.
Wow.
A trampoline, a hot tub. Yeah. So
that's nice.
And I just happened to hit them at the right time. They were just remodeling their community house, and included in the remodeling, they were making a one-bedroom wheelchair accessible unit because they wanted to increase the diversity there.
Wow. Wait.
So, yeah.
How? Why don't we H E A hear about T H those kinds of things?
Why don't we hear about them?
Yeah, you don't hear about stuff like that. People creating a situation like that, which seems like a really neat thing to know about.
It really is. I lucked out because about 5 years ago when I said, you know, Berkeley's just getting too big for me, I want something smaller. And I said, I want to live around a group of people that really care about each other, and I want to be around children more. And I was just talking to someone about it. Someone I hardly knew, but we just got into a conversation once, and he said, well, why don't you do an internet search for what's called intentional communities?
Uh-huh.
So I did, and I found just all kinds of places. And, you know, some have a real particular theme, like they're for people who, you know, like there'll be a community that's all vegans, or there'll be a community that's all a certain religion, and but they're all over the world. And there were two in Davis. And so I started looking into them.
I just G Oh, I just got B A back in to C O communication contact. In the late '70s, Frank lived in a commune in Massachusetts. And I guess they're having a reunion coming up.
Oh,
and so
really?
Somebody's been trying to reach everybody. 350 people lived in this community.
It doesn't exist anymore, though. It's not there. But there's a reunion of,
So a lot of the people that he knew then are all of a sudden emailing each other and catching up on what, you know, what they've been doing the last 35 years.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wow. My sister and I were laughing because we went to Catholic parochial school, and they're sending out notices for a reunion, and we were saying, why have an alumni organization for a school that only goes to the 8th grade, and then, but it's their 50th anniversary, and we were laughing because our father married the first principal of that school. She left the convent and married our father.
Whoa.
And so we thought we would...
Whoa.
So we thought if they keep sending us all this mail about their reunion, we're going to write to them and say, do you really want the stepchildren of the first principal to come to your reunion? But I think a lot of people our age start to want to kind of reconnect with people that they knew when they were younger, don't you?
Yes, and my PA past has always, Frank seems to, there's always like something, you know, where there's somebody from his past kind of showing up. It's kind of been a theme. It's like it's more hotter and heavier now, it seems like, because you have people from all various aspects of your past coming. But that's always been a, it's always
but
been
they,
there.
But they can always probably find you, though, right?
High profile type of guy that
he
is.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you try to find them, you might have trouble, but they can find
you.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. B E T between B E T. S. Betsy. I'm one of the people from the community. No, Betsy. From Redlands. Was a at. Oh, she's the one that you've been just recently talking to that lives out in the boondocks in the Sierra foothills or something. Right, so that was from San Bernardino when you went to school there.
She was at a dinner or Thanksgiving,
right?
And somebody started talking about Frank.
They were talking about this incredible performance artist that's doing this really unique thing that seems really important. And then it turns out that it's Frank, and she went to college with him in San Bernardino.
And she knew nothing about what you've been doing since then.
No.
Wow.
And then I guess she found Frank on the internet and wrote him and told him about this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's always fun when those kinds of things happen. So have you seen her? Have you actually met?
They emailed back and forth a bit.
Wow.
S. So, how was it? G. R. Growing up
In Nebraska. Well, actually, when I say it's the second worst place to be from, it's not really to be from, it's to live there that I would hate to do. But, I think I learned a lot about work ethics and honesty, and I think it gave me a real good foundation for being a good person. But it was so conservative, and so, you know, the people there just had such a narrow way of thinking, and I just didn't fit. And I I just was never happy there as a child, but it did give me, I think, a lot of good tools to bring into the world. And you know, I mean, when I go to do a job, I want to do a job well. And I think a lot of the youth that we see today, they don't have the same kind of philosophy towards work. It's like, oh, I have to do this because I'm getting paid to do it. But they don't generally think in the same kind of work ethic as I think I got in Nebraska. So a lot of good stuff I got, but I sure would hate to live there now. I mean, I went back for my 30th class reunion, and it was just shocking.
We did that. Frank had a 30th class reunion. Oh, old. Everybody seemed old.
Yes. And one guy came up to me and says, how come you don't have any gray hair? I do now, but I didn't then. He says, how come you don't have any gray hair? I just don't. And he says, you've dyed it. And I says, no, I haven't. And he couldn't believe it. But you're right.
Frank was actually older than most of the people because of the, like, mainstreaming and all the weird stuff that went on. He ended up being older than everybody. So he was a lot older than the people there.
But I think when you stay, you know, when you stay alive and active and you have a lot of energetic and fun and creative things happening in your life, you stay younger.
Yeah. Yes. And artists tend to seem to stay younger more than non-artists.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. How did Michael? How did you? Sorry. How did you get out of Nebraska?
Well, I went from Nebraska to Denver for college. And then when I was almost finished with college, I wound up married. And then we decided we hated the Midwest, so we moved to Oregon because I had an uncle that lived there and could get us jobs. And
you want to stop?
You want me to stop?
He's gone.
Dump. And then.
You want to go back to being married in Denver? After? No, even before that. Okay. B, E, because when I... W went to G O go to college R E rehab would not
yes
S S E N send me away from your home area.
I know what you're getting at. And I've always been really creative with the system. And I was a Shriners kid because I had had polio, and at that time Shriners were helping children with polio. And I was kind of like the hometown Shriners girl. So when I graduated with honors, they gave me a scholarship for 2 years to our community college. So I went for my first 2 years to the community college. Then I approached Voc Rehab and said, I want to get a four-year degree. I've already had 2 years of it paid for, and you didn't have to pay a cent for that. So will you pay for the next 2 years? And, you know, I just had to really do a good song and dance, and they wanted to send me in my own state because the tuition would have been cheaper, but I convinced them that Denver University did not cover very much ground. It was very, all the buildings were close together, whereas the University of Nebraska was spread out all over, and I was walking on braces and crutches, and so I said, you know, well, Denver University I'll be able to get around at, whereas University of Nebraska I can't. So.
Wow, pretty good. Pretty good. Wow. I when I had no when I W E went to E N R enroll, when I went to enroll in a junior college, they would, they would not T A take me because I drooled.
Oh, really? What were you trying to major in? I mean, cooking, I could see maybe that would be a problem, but...
like you, M-A-S-S, mass, C, communication.
Communications, yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, that was, let's see, you're a little bit older than me, right?
He's turned 60 this year.
Yeah, so we're talking when people had real antique attitudes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was the first, like the first disabled kid to go into regular schools and the first disabled kid to
so
try to get into colleges.
So you went to mainstream school also as a child?
Some of them. The first M mainstream H high school.
Fantastic. Wow. Because that was before the law. The law wasn't insisting on it at that time. No. Did who advocated? Was you or your parents? I mean, who made sure that you got in there?
M. You. M. Oh. Mom.
Your mom.
Always. Your mom always pushed. She always pushed. But I G O I got on the S C H school P A paper in H in high school.
Really? And you wrote, were as a journalist on the school paper?
My, no, P, political. You had a political column. This was 1965, 66.
Wow.
Before being against the war was okay.
Yeah.
I and I did things like D E, debate, A, GI, who was in Vietnam, in Frank, in the paper.
Ah, see, you were radicalized in high school. I wasn't radicalized until I went to college in Denver. I mean, in high school, the only organization, only extracurricular things I did was I joined the chess club and Future Teachers of America.
They, S, A, they saw me as their poster child. Because this is like he's the first mainstream and he's supposed to be setting some kind of example so that they could keep this thing going.
So they let you keep up with your political column? They didn't try to stop it?
My P O L I political did not F I fit your politics didn't fit their poster child image. S so my T my teacher that thing where the teacher explained to Frank that he was ruining it for everybody that was to follow him by doing things like this. I said, is not the idea to make it so that disabled people can be like anybody else, can be free to do and be who they are?
And have their own opinions.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Duh.
It's like when I went away to college, I grew my hair long for the first time, and I started wearing, kind of sloppy looking hippie clothes. And, back in Nebraska, I had just, looked like goody two shoes. And there was this guy who was a basketball player, but he also wasn't straight at all. But everyone thought he was because he was a basketball player, so he had this image. But he and I were pals, and so he and I visited each other. He came up to Denver and visited me a lot, and so he and I both kind of really knew what was real. And his mom, he'd go home, and his mom one day said, "Have you seen Pam Walker lately? I heard she was in town last week. I don't know what's happened to that girl. She's just gone to the dogs. She was such a nice girl. And now look what's happened to her. Now that she's gone away to college, she's just got involved with some cult or I don't know." But his mother didn't know that he and I were good buddies. And so he came back and told me that. So, yeah, the same thing. I was, once I started having an opinion and, doing anti-war demonstrations, all of a sudden I wasn't anyone's poster child.
My F I R first E S essay after the pointer. Yeah, because Frank was trying to get them to do a pointer for quite a while before they would, because before that they were trying to get him to use his fingers to type. And so he was really falling behind in school. And so finally he got a teacher to rig like a Lego thing for him to and right away, of course, he's like typing. And so his first essay was about a world government. And everybody was like, what?
That would be even radical today. Wow. What did you read a lot when you were a kid? I mean, how did you get so radicalized?
Yes, he read a lot. Yeah. 'Cause a lot of times that's what, what he could do.
Yeah.
'Cause it was in E, especially in Germany, and when they would not take you in the school. His dad was in the Air Force, and so they traveled all over the place, and so wherever they were, he either could go to the school or not.
Depending on the local attitude.
Yeah. So in Germany, he was just stuck with his mom in the apartment. And so he ended up reading a lot of books. And she had a radical friend who would pass him all these books.
Well, I was going to say, I read a lot too, but I think I was reading different books.
Yeah. I read all kinds of books.
Well, when I went to college, I had a sociology teacher that he gave us a whole list of books, and he said, you can get 10 points for every one of these books you read and write a report on. And it was that was my door opening, because that was the first time I was exposed to any of these ideas. And on that list, he had things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Population Bomb, you know, just all of the books that came out of that time period that really radicalized just our way of thinking. Ken Kesey's Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, that was on the list. There was just all these great books, and I got so many points. I got an A in that class because I read almost every book on the list, and just doors were opened up for me. Yeah.
I am L lucky because I have M E met most of your heroes.
Really?
Yeah. Ken Kesey being one of them.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, you know, they always ask you what, you know, if you could meet four people that you would like to meet, you know, who would they be? And, you know, Ken Kesey would probably be on my list as one that I would like to meet. So.
We, W, E, went. Was that when we went to Cody's? Is it, no, we went to A, D. Oh, you're talking about the other, the Claremont Hotel had a drug symposium. This was like in the late 80s. And we went. And was at the time, Frank had like, I don't know, four or five students that had been working with him. So he treated everybody to this symposium. So there's like, you know, six, eight of us, something like that. And we walk in the door, Timothy Leary comes running up to us as if he knew us.
Oh,
and
wow.
Like, wait, and he's hugging us and saying, I'm so glad you got here. I'm so glad you made it and all this. And it's like the whole thing was like a drug experience, because it was all like that. Ram Dass was there. He came up and was hugging us.
Wow.
There were a lot of people there.
Well, they must have heard of you then, huh? I mean,
I don't know, or we just kind of seemed a certain way.
Just your group coming
in.
Yeah,
there was something about us. They could feel us or something.
This is the truth of what the 60s was about. Yeah.
Yeah. We, Ben, D, you, during, the, B, break. During the break, Leary was sitting there talking to this young guy who was all kind of goo-goo-eyed at Leary. And we were walking by, and Frank just did this with his hand, like at Leary. And Leary right away starts playing with Frank. And so we stop, and they're doing this whole little hand jive thing. You know, Leary's moving just like Frank and having a good time. And the guy is like, you know, trying to get it.
That's great.
How? H. A. Hard was it to get O out?
To get out.
Like out of the house, out of the nuclear family situation?
To get out. There's a lot of ways I've gotten out.
Yes.
So, which one?
All of them? Well, what were you going to say? The are not they see O connected?
Actually, you know, that's a very good way of putting it. Okay. let's see. I'm a bisexual, and one time somebody asked me how what was the process of you realizing you were bisexual, and how difficult was that because of, you know, you happen to you know, come out to your friends and your family and everything. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, there's so many ways that I have been so different all my life that there wasn't anything different about this. This was just a different way of being different. But I'd already learned how to be different. You know, I'd been different all my life. So
yes,
that to me, yeah, you come. Once you learn how to come out, then whatever comes, you're out, you know, and you find that that's where your truth is. You've got to be who you are. You can't hide it. Or, you know, the minute you start hiding who you really are from other people, I just discovered that it's the secrecy that you carry around inside of you that turns you ugly. And to just be who you are is what really makes you not only joyous to yourself, but real, to be real in the world. And so, you know, it's just learning how to be out. I had to learn how to be out in so many ways, but probably how to be out of Nebraska was the first one. Yeah. How to learn how to be out of Nebraska. That was the hardest one. And I did have a nervous breakdown in college, and I really think it was because I had been born and raised for 20 years in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. And then suddenly to be in a whole different place where I didn't have everyone know my name, everyone know my family's history, and everyone, you know, make assumptions based on who I was. And all of a sudden to be a stranger on the streets, it was just hard. I just had this real identity crisis. And then out of that, I realized, you know, okay, this is someone new. I'm not the Nebraska girl anymore. Mm-hmm. So now I guess it's a matter of finding out who I am.
In my time, my M-O, my mom, H-A, had to P-U push me to C-L-A S classes.
Push you physically.
Yeah, push the wheelchair.
You don't mean she had to say, come on, Frank, you're going. Yeah. You meant she had to physically push you.
She pushed his wheelchair in junior college. Having your mom and college with you really cramps your style, no matter how great she might be.
Yeah, that would do it. I mean, I had family too, but they were my sisters, so, you know, sometimes that kind of helps. But although, you know, often it was like, your sister's really cute. You think she'd go out with me? And, you know, it would be somebody I had a crush on. So, you know, but yeah, my family helped me because when I went away to college, I lived with my sisters. They moved to Denver with me. So, you know, family was there to give me the support, the physical support I needed.
S. So, when I transferred to S San Bernardino State, she could not afford to be there to push you to your classes, to take C classes herself. So she was taking classes at the junior college with you.
You mean in order for them to allow her to go with you, she had to...
That's just something she wanted to do.
Ah, okay.
She wanted to do it.
Huh. So then that was the point then that, that you and your mother were no longer in this relationship of dependency.
But S T I, but still, it in the S A same C I city. You were still in the same city.
Okay.
So it was hard to be independent of her. You weren't living at home at that point, or were you? Some of the time, yes. Some of the time, you were still living at home. Yeah. B. E. Because. Being. N. E. A. Near. Home. It was hard to break away completely.
Definitely. I mean, as you've read my book, so you see that my real break into being totally independent was when I found myself living alone for the first time in my life. And it was just circumstances that led to that, where all of a sudden I didn't have sisters to help me out. I didn't have a husband to help me out. And I didn't have all these people automatically built into my support system. And so then I had to start answering, how am I going to get these needs met? And then you come face to face with that. Then that's, I think, when you have to start building your real roads towards independence.
I, H, A, I had to... D. R. Drop out of college in S. E. Second. S. E. C. In secret.
Oh, really?
And H. I. Hitchhike to Santa Fe. That's how he broke away.
Oh, I gotta hear this. how do you hitchhike in a power wheelchair?
This is way before power wheelchairs.
You still had a manual wheelchair?
Yeah, this is before there were
power
wheelchairs.
But I assume you were using a head pointer then by that time, right?
Yes.
So... How do you...
A, C, actually, I, H, A, had, A, C, O, L, college, friend, D, drive, me, to, S, A, Santa Fe, and D, drop me off at a crash pad.
Ah, okay. So then there you found rides. Yeah.
Well, at that point, let's see. That's how you got from San Bernardino to Santa Fe, was the college friend. And they he didn't know, Frank didn't know anybody at the crash pad. He just had to, the guy drop him off. And then, and he also didn't have any money because he didn't, he have to, you know, switch all the SSI stuff to a different state. And so none of that was happening. And and the plan was, this woman had, Louise had, when he was kind of like saying how he wishes he could get out of the house, and she said, I'm moving to Santa Fe. He didn't know her very well. And she said, well, why don't you just come and live with me? And so, but she had to sell her home. And so she said, I'll be there like in a week. So he did this whole thing where he sneaks, you know, he hides in secret and gets this ride, gets dropped off thinking she'll be there in a week. Well, it took her months to get there.
Oh, no.
So he lived in this crash pad where every morning he had to, you know, count on finding somebody that would get him up, put him on the toilet, dress him, bathe him, feed him, you know, everything for months.
Wow. I think of the times when I've been at a crash pad and everybody's laying around half out of it.
Yeah.
And I can just, you know, see the door opens and you roll in. Someone's like, wow, what did I take? I could swear I saw a guy in a wheelchair just come in here.
With a pointer on his head.
With a pointer drooling.
No. Emma. Oh. No money.
Oh, no. And they didn't kick you out, huh? They didn't dare. It would have been so, that would have been so against what, hey man, what crash pads were all about, dude, you know?
I W O N wonder if it H A had B, Ben, T, O, now, today?
No. I don't think it would happen now. But you know what? That's the group you need to have a reunion with. I don't think it would today, do you? I don't think it would.
No. S. H, S-H-O, no, so, how do they do it today?
Well, fortunately, a lot of support systems are around now that weren't around when we were doing it. I mean, and I think it has both its advantages and disadvantages. I think the advantage is it's a whole lot easier. You know, you can go to an independent living center and get some help. You can get help from different programs. SSI did not exist when you and I were first starting college. You know, there's a lot of ways that there are supports there. But also, there's a whole lot of disabled youth that are getting spoiled rotten. And then when they're turned out of school and they don't have everything done for them, they don't know how to survive. They haven't learned the ropes the hard way like you and I did. And so in one sense, you know, I'm afraid that people are being done a disservice by having so much done for them. And you know, when I talk to teachers who are studying to be teachers of students with disabilities, I tell them, you know, if you're wondering whether a student can do a project you've assigned to them, I says, I think it's better that you err in the direction of expecting too much of them than to err in the direction of not expecting enough. And don't solve it for them. Don't tell them, oh, okay, you can't do it that way. Well, then we'll have you do it this way. Instead, say, oh, you can't do it that way. Well, then, what way could you do it? And teach them, the greatest thing you can teach them is to think for themselves how to solve a problem that they encounter because of their disability. Because you're not always going to be there to solve every problem that they're going to encounter. So.
And A, L, also, to be E Q equal R E S equally responsible in there R E A L relationships.
Yeah, yeah. Don't expect that just because you're disabled that you get to, you know, you get something just because you're disabled. And I think some are you learning it and some aren't. I mean, I just read an article tonight about this young woman who is like the best disc jockey in Michigan who is disabled. And she's the top slam disc jockey. And it's really a great article. I was just really enjoying reading and I thought, go girl. And you know, the one thing that they have going for them today that they that we didn't have going for them is they have you and me and other role models, and they can see examples of people who fought their way the hard way because they had, you know, they wanted something bad enough that they fought the hard way to get it, and then they can see examples of people that have done it. So I think they have that going for them.
My H, I, high school, T, E, teacher, in the F, D, A, D, I, S, A, disability, H, high school, H-O, homeroom, was a H A R hard A ass
artist. And aren't you glad for it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I can tell stories about teachers that let me get away with stuff, and that's part another reason why I think my college life was so hard, because I didn't learn how to set goals. I didn't learn how to do anything the hard way. I didn't learn how to study because my teachers in my hometown had just let me get away with stuff. They just gave me good grades just because I had done it. You know, it's like because I was so courageous and had done it, they thought I deserved an A. They didn't look at the quality of the work I'd done, and I didn't study for anything. So,
and that MA makes you D O doubly D O U B T doubt yourself.
You don't have a reality check. You know, that's how I felt when I started making videos. People who were non-disabled would say, "Wow, that's really great." But I didn't know if they meant, "Oh, that's really great because you're a handicapped person and you've done something. So it's really great that you did something," you know? And then people that I knew who were disabled said, "Wow, that's really great." But I didn't know if they were saying that just because they were so hungry for anything on disability. And so I couldn't tell, is the work I'm doing good or not? And so I finally just said, I don't care. If I like it, it's good. What's important is for me to like it.
Yes. Yes.
I'm going to give you a copy of a video I call Art. Art with a question mark. And it's one of the one of the favorite videos that I've ever made of my own. And hardly anyone's ever seen it. Most people don't like it, but I really like it. So I'm going to give you a copy of that.
How did you start getting in to art? F R from J O U R journalism.
From journalism? Well, actually, I started out in psychology. I went from psychology to sociology to journalism to, you know, I took a lot of winding roads. And that gives me a good chance to plug my book. Can I plug my book? Because it's a long
Mikey?
Journey. My book, Close Upon the Book. Mikey left
the room. Where's our guy?
Right
he'll
when
be
we
back.
Need the Close Upon the Book. But
he'll get it.
But my book, Moving Over the Edge, Artists with Disabilities Take the Leap. And it really shows the long meandering journey that it took me to get from a little kid that didn't believe art could be part of my life, that I had to keep it all secret, that you know, nobody was reinforcing being an
Why?
Artist.
Why did you think that?
Well, for one thing, I didn't see any artists that were disabled. And if I even tried to do anything artistic, it was only done like in therapy or, you know, my family said, you know, you're not going to be able to be a waitress like your sisters, so you have to get a good education. So you have to be on a college track. You have to take serious classes. You know, art was just not part of the picture for me. And so I went from this kid that felt really creative inside, but I felt like I had to keep it all a secret. So I did keep it a secret. And then just slowly through the book, you find out how just I began to dabble and let a little bit of out and a little bit out. And then finally just full-fledged artist, you know. So, but it's a long, it was a long meandering road, that part of it. Yeah.
Four. Me. They. T. H. O. They thought. I. Could. O. Only write.
Yeah. Me, they wanted to be a teacher or a secretary. That's what Voc Rehab first wanted me to go to school for, was to be a secretary. And I told him, I've been through 2 years of community college preparing for a psychology degree, and you want me to be a secretary? I don't think so. Yeah.
Yes. V. Voc Rehab. Wanted me to F G O go to D A day T R A I training.
Oh, a sheltered workshop.
This was after 4 years of college of H I 4 years of high school of 4 years of college H I of high grades 4 years of high grades in college.
Ditto. I you know, I they once I got out and then it was time to look for work. The only work they were helping me find was work as an accountant, you know, doing bookkeeping and that kind of thing. And I'd like to think it's changed, and I think it is a little bit, but it's still really tough. But I found out eventually that the deal was, as soon as they close the books on a person, they get points. And they have to close so many books a month, or they're going to lose their job. So it's to their benefit to get you into a job that they can get you into as quickly as possible. So they don't want to send you to 2 years of college. They want to send you to a training program for 2 months and then get you into a job, because then they can close the book and they get the points for closing the book. So that's the way the system used to work. And, you know, I think they're more sensitive now because they see how far that's gotten them. I mean, the unemployment of people with disabilities is a whole lot higher than any other group in our country. So they've seen that what they were doing does not work.
Then, when I, wanted to go to graduate school in art, A-R-T, art is not a career.
Yeah, they're starting to change their mind about that, but very slowly. Very slowly, because a lot of us have been working on a national level with the Department of Social Security and with Voc Rehab and showing them that art, like we've made lists of all the, a whole variety of jobs that could be called art jobs. And you know, everything from arts administration to graphic designers to, and, you know, there's a, over, you know, a couple hundred jobs that are in the art field. And we say, how can you say art is not a career?
They wanted me to sign S saying I would T-A take any job they found.
Oh. Sneaky, sneaky. In other words, they'd send you to school as long as you would take any job they found.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I hope you didn't sign.
No.
Well, Voc Rehab did not help me in graduate school. I was already in a position at a university, so I was able to take graduate classes at instructor's rate, which was like $9 an hour or something like that. I mean, per credit, you know. So Voc Rehab, I have very rarely heard them helping anybody with graduate school.
This was W I with A L E T T letter from E D letter from E D Ed,
from Ed
Roberts. Who was the head of V Voc Rehab at the time. I J H A I had S U C E successfully G O gotten A M A. So you're talking to them about your second master's degree. He had already gotten an MA in psychology. Uh-huh. And now he wanted to get an MA in art.
But art's not a career. Oh, since our cameraman's back. Can we show the back of the book, though?
Oh, the back, yeah.
Because that has a sexy before and after pictures of me. I was, when I was trying to figure out what to do for the back cover of the book, I was looking through all my old photographs. And it was just so funny when I came across the black and white one of me. And that's a medical picture. You know how doctors always used to put braces or something on us and then they'd take a picture of us? So that's a medical picture of me holding up, showing my new braces, my fancy new braces. And it was just coincidental that that is my left leg. And then the picture of me at the exotic erotic ball, it's my left leg that's exposed. So I thought, oh, that's perfect. That's the before and after pictures. You? Pamela, before and after as an artist.
You are D R E dressed. They you S usually took pictures like in your underwear or something.
I know. If even that. Definitely. I know. When people would ask me how I got good at acting, I says, you know, I've been acting all my life because, you know, when you're laying on a hospital table and you have a doctor bring in a crew of medical students and they start talking about your body and you're laying there naked, you know, you learn to put on a show.
They should T, they should T-A, take their clothes off if they're going
That's
to.
That's right. Maybe what we should do is go into the children's hospital, make up some signs that say nudity zone, nudity required in this zone, and then put them up all over so that all of the interns and the doctors have to be nude also.
And they. W O wonder why we don't have I N inhibitions about our bodies.
Why are we such exhibitionists, you know? Definitely.
You do all K kinds of art.
Pretty much, about the only thing I don't do very much. Well, even that I kind of do just for my own pleasure is play a musical instrument, you know, but that's about the only thing I don't do. Yeah. Yeah.
They all are P-L-A play.
Yeah. All. True. I play a lot. Yeah.
M O most people don't get that.
Enough play?
They don't get that that's what art is or can be. It's just
that
play.
It can be play. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
In they think it, they have to be one, they have to be one kind of artist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. To just really stick with one kind and excel at it. But, you know, a lot of people do a lot of things. I mean, Laurie Anderson and Madonna, and, you know, you see them breaking out into other things all the time, and a lot of artists. But usually, they have to make it first. They have to really make it, you know, become a real popular icon before they will begin to break out into their other arts. You know, first they stick on one track.
I was always L-U lucky. No one No one thought, Frank always says, no one thought he could be good at anything. So he didn't have that kind of pressure. He could just play and just explore and have a good time because there weren't anybody laying, this is the way you have to do it. Cause, he can't paint. He can't, you know.
Well, to me, art is a way of life. It's not just what you do, you know, in this little square that you call, okay, now I'm working on my art, right? Even the terminology people use, they say, I'm working it on my art, or I work as an artist, or, you know, what kind of work do you do? I'm an artist, you know? Mm-hmm. Even the terminology makes it sound like work, whereas to me, it's like some people express their art in different ways, but it's like, how you fix your apartment, how, you know, what you do, you know, how you express yourself in your clothes, how you go down the street and greet people. I mean, their art is just, it's a way of living. It's a way of being in the world. Yes. Mm-hmm. By the way, you, Linda and Frank, have got to sign my book. Because everyone that's in my book has got to sign my book.
I'd love
to.
Yeah.
So the page that...
Oh, we sign our page?
You sign a page that has your name on it, yeah.
Oh, cool.
You can take up as much space.
Oh, look at all this. Oh, fun. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's my autograph book.
Wow, that's fun. What a good idea. I even found the section.
You found the section?
You ready to sign, Frank? Let me give you a pen.
For the viewers, I'll tell you that I do, one of the chapters is
right
on four artists that I highlight, and Frank is one of the artists that I highlight. And I talk about him in there a lot, and my first impression of him.
Hold the book, yeah, that would be great. Okay. Okay, you ready? Boom. Do you want me to write Frank Moore's sign? Sometimes I do that, or else I just leave it as it is.
You can just draw a line to his name, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. Find his name on the page and draw a line to it.
Okay, great.
That'd be great. Thanks.
Okay.
Can I give a plug for the website people can go to find out my... Okay, if you're interested in knowing how to buy the book, you can go to website... www.mhortonmedia.com. That's M as in Michael, Horton, Horton, Media, Media, no periods, .com. mhortonmedia.com. And it's $25, and you can buy it through PayPal on the website, or it'll give the address you can send your money to. My Nebraska accent is slipping out. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
A. S. As. The. E. G. O. I. Egoist.
Who, you or me?
That I am, as the egoist I am, would you, R, E, A, read what you wrote about Frank?
Mm-hmm. I would love to. Let me take my glasses off. I'm one of those old ladies that has to take her glasses off to read. So let me see. What page is it? I'm sure you've got it.
I got it marked.
Oh, there it is.
You found it?
Well, I found the chapter.
Yeah,
so
there it is.
There we go. Linda, you didn't sign
it. I did sign
it. Did you?
My name came toward the end of his section, so I put it there.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Got
there.
It. All right. I knew I'd
you,
have to eat these words someday.
You did not even say I was paraplegic which, I mean, Frank's not paraplegic, but everybody who's ever written about him says he's paraplegic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. P A R A paraplegic.
Paralyzed.
Oh, that he's paralyzed.
Oh, really?
Right, that's what people, he's paralyzed from his neck down. Or he's 99% paralyzed.
Oh, wow.
99%
disabled.
Now, I'd say only 95. I mean, you can move your eyes, your nose. Well, I tried in the book to not make people their disabilities. You know what I mean? I mean, I try to describe people as I see them, but not as not making assumptions about their disabilities or not defining them by their disabilities.
Mm.
Yeah, so.
You, if I was P.A. paralyzed, you wouldn't be moving.
No.
You'd just be totally sitting there like that.
That's right.
Trying to get your head down to the board.
And if you were 99% paralyzed, all you could move would be your eyes, you know, if you were 99% disabled. Well, maybe not your eyes and just your nose, but one body part. Okay, so I will read the part about Frank Moore. Deep breath. Oops, my mic slipped. Frank Moore is a thin, wiry man with a full body of energy. His arms and legs spasm and shake with the beat of cerebral palsy. His speech is difficult to understand, so he often communicates by using a pointer on his head to indicate words or letters on a board. Frank typically dresses in tie-dyed clothes from head to toe, and his power wheelchair is brightly decorated. He wears humongous glasses. Uh-oh. I lied.
His eyesight's changing.
And drools through his misshapen teeth. Wild hair flies around his head. And his chin is covered by a straggly beard. Okay, I was right on that part. Have I just described an erotic genius? Yes. Frank usually has a crowd of people around him, adoring him and touching him, being close to him. He has helped many people learn about their erotic energies and to express themselves more fully. He focuses on touch in much of his art, encouraging people to be playful. His performances have a reputation for being wild and shocking, yet moving. During the 1970s, Frank performed with his cabaret, The Outrageous Beauty Review, at a San Francisco nightclub called the Mubahe Gardens. Men in wheelchairs singing Macho Man with pride and gusto is one example of the types of things they did. The first story I heard about Frank tells of his entering the stage in his power wheelchair, totally nude. Several women lifted him and laid him on the floor. They poured spaghetti on him, and the performance consisted of their eating it off his body. Was that true? Did that really happen?
That's actually a combination of acts.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because there was the spaghetti, and there was always women carrying naked.
That was a rumor I heard, and I never knew was it was true.
Hoffman? Steve Hoffman was the one who did the spaghetti.
Okay.
So he was the one covered in the spaghetti.
Okay.
Entered. It was like, you know, there was classical music playing, and he was all dressed up like in a tux type thing, and he enters like this, and he comes up to this table all set nicely with, you know, a lot of messy food on it. And he sits there, and he's ready to eat, and he's, you know, very like this, and all of a sudden he goes, and he just throws himself on the table. The table collapses. He's covered in the food, and then he just writhes around in the food for a while.
I see. Okay. Got it. So it was two stories being meshed together.
Yeah.
Got it. For Frank to expose his body the way that he does helps many people to feel less conscious about their bodies. Body acceptance is a beautiful thing. Lack of body acceptance is an ugly thing. Frank shows that the line between beautiful and ugly has more to do with how one feels than with how one looks. He does this as work, play, art. Mm. After seeing Frank proudly display his unusual body so easily, with no sense of shame, I began to flaunt my atrophied legs almost as much as I exposed my cleavage. I began to feel comfortable in shorts on hot summer days and to attend gala functions in short skirts and nylons. Frank's influence enabled me to attend the exotic erotic ball in a revealing outfit that led to 4 compliments on my legs, 3 sexual propositions, 2 requests for dances, and 1 proposal of marriage. For several years, I've also danced scantily clad in San Francisco's annual carnival, resulting 1 year in a photograph of me in Utney Reader. Whether on stage, at a costume event, or in the public, my legs don't have to be hidden. I wouldn't go so far as to say that Frank turned me into an exhibitionist, but his head stick euphemistically pointed me in that direction. Frank also taught me to be freer in creating my art, to worry less about who it might offend. He is always pushing boundaries. In 1990, he was one of the handful of NEA-funded artists that Senator Jesse Helms demanded be investigated for obscenity. Frank. I admire the work that Frank has done regarding free speech and anti-censorship. I heard him on public radio once at a time when many artists were being censored. Knowing that it is almost impossible to understand what he says, Frank went on the air and said the 7 dirty words that are not allowed on radio. It was hysterically funny, one of the cleverest broadcasts I've ever heard. Speaking of censorship, I want to take a side road for just a moment to talk about the current threat to freedom of expression in our country. If society wants to protect itself from difficult images, disability is a prime candidate for censorship. Many people are uncomfortable with disability-related material, sometimes even finding it disturbing or offensive. People can be afraid of us, and they may fear becoming disabled themselves. Those fears not only create obstacles to inclusion, but they give an impetus for people to avoid us. It is important for artists with disabilities to be able to express themselves, even or especially related to sexuality. We've been told that we are not sexual beings, but some of us are challenging that through our artistic expressions. It is important that artists with disabilities not be censored. Freedom of expression is our ally. The trickiness of anti-censorship is that if we want the freedom to say what we think, we need to let others say what they think. I have a right to talk about how I think my body is beautiful. Others have a right to call my body deformed. I have a right to say that it is my opinion that many people with disabilities who want to die but need better support, not death. Others have the right to say that it's their opinion that a severely disabled life is not one worth living. Unfortunately, under a freedom of speech banner, sometimes people deviate from anti-censorship to action or incitement to action. An anti-abortionist group had a website that listed the names and home addresses of doctors who had performed abortions. It encouraged anti-abortionists to cause physical harm to the doctors and their families. Freedom of speech means that the anti-abortionist group had a right to have a website stating their opinions about abortion. It does not mean that the group had a right to encourage violence. Jack Kevorkian has a right to his opinions about assisted suicide, but so do the not dead yet folks. Kevorkian can easily get the press to cover his side, but where is the press when a spokesperson for an opposing organization has an opinion? One form of censorship is failing to tell both sides, or suppressing a story. Censorship, anti-censorship, can be a fine line that will likely never be permanently drawn. Frank Moore states on his website, quote, "There will always be thought cops and other forces of repression with their cold mugs of hemlock. We artists who deal in cultural subversion, some call it corruption of morals, should always be prepared to take that bitter drink," end quote. Frank's work is considered controversial, pushing boundaries of body acceptance, eroticism, pornography, and sexuality. I don't always like the message he conveys, but I respect his work immensely. And sometimes I have thoroughly enjoyed his work. Oh, like the time he performed on stage with Nina Hartley, a famous adult movie star. Frank sat in his wheelchair while Nina danced with him, wearing only thong panties. Three nude people moved in circles around them, wrapping them in white toilet paper, tin foil, and saran wrap. It was beautiful, erotic, playful, and completely whacked. Typical Frank Moore. Frank is respected as an artist across the country from Greenwich Village to San Francisco. The last time I saw him perform was at a benefit for Annie Sprinkle, a famous erotic performance artist whose houseboat had burned down. Dressed as Sonny and Cher, Frank and Linda sang "I Got You, Babe." Frank is so far over the edge that most of us cannot even see him. He's the kind of trailblazer that is a hard act to follow. I interviewed him in his home once for the Barrier Free TV show. But the experience was so surreal that my memory of it is dreamlike fog. People tend to either love him or hate him. One thing that most will agree on, the man's got guts. Frank Moore's name belongs in art history books, in a chapter on erotic artists. That is saying a lot when you think about the fact that society considers people with disabilities as asexual. My greatest respect for Frank is due to his persistent and primordial twisting of minds around that stereotype.
That's so great.
Now, did I misrepresent anything? Did I tell any lies?
N. I. Nina Hartley was N. Nude.
No, she had thong underpants.
Is that the Mitchell brothers?
Yeah.
Was she nude? Oh, let's give her a call.
Don't we have it on video somewhere?
Nina, were you wearing thong underpants? Or
but you're talking about because of the rule, but they would not let her sit on Frank's lap.
Oh, really?
And I thought that was because of the nudity. You know, because... Yeah.
You know what I might be thinking about is, you know, she has that beautiful tan because she wears her thong underpants and has that beautiful pant.
Right.
That might be. May be what in my memory I was seeing it.
I remember that tan line.
Yeah, her tan line is always the same.
Because the rest of us were nude, and so Frank asked her if she would do that, even though that's not what she normally did. And then their rules were that because she's nude, she's not allowed to sit on Frank's lap.
Okay.
And Emma, A, N, man, on a man's lap, on stage. She's not allowed to sit on a man's lap
if she's
on
nude,
stage.
If she's nude.
She could eat a woman on stage.
She could, yeah?
Did.
But she couldn't
sit on
a man's lap nude.
Yeah.
Okay, I know she moved against you a lot, brushed up
against
you a lot.
Yes.
But yeah, she.
They. L. A. Lap danced in the audience, and that was okay.
Oh, but it's on the stage.
Yeah.
Well, I will make a note in my revision before it goes to its second printing.
I. R. O. Ironic. It was that's ironic. It is the M O the most R I G rigid circumstances that we performed under.
Really?
Because most
at
the of
the Mitchell Brothers
yeah,
house. That's
right.
Funny.
Because most of the time we do any of that, whatever we want to do. But in that case, there were like rules of what we could and couldn't do.
Probably because they were under such constant surveillance to
yes.
get shut down. They had to be really,
right.
really.
Right. Yes. At C H churches. We're very explicitly nude and erotic and doing all sorts of things. No problem. Universities, no problem. Mitchell Brothers Adult Theater.
That's funny. Well, I state one more line about you in my summary where I give just one last plug for everything that everyone said. And I say, Frank taught me to be non-judgmental about my art. And to laugh playfully while dancing with the muse. And I want to thank you for that, Frank.
Where? When? I. R. E. A. Read. That. My. M, I, my mind was blown when you read Pam's whole chapter. Your mind was blown. Is that what you mean? That last section? That last part that she just read, your mind was blown.
Well, you know, I'll bet you never realized you had that impact on me. And I think we go through life a lot of times never knowing the people who we've had an impact on. Unless something comes out and we find out, you know, and there, I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because there's so many people that gave me little pieces along the way that helped me to get to where I am, and I wanted to immortalize them and tell their stories and how the impact they had on me. And so, yeah, you probably had no idea that you know, I mean, as far as I know, you never even saw me. You didn't know I was in that audience. No, all you saw was Nina.
No. Did you know that Pam? No, we didn't know
you didn't
were
know
in
I
the
was
audience.
In that audience.
No.
Yeah. I figured you probably didn't. And I'm sure you didn't know I was in the Annie Sprinkle audience because that
was
such
a big
crowd.
Audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I've been in different places and things along the way and seen your art, and really it's been part of, you know, as an artist, you know that we just take pieces of this and that, and it all kind of moves around inside of us and has an effect on us.
My, we don't know most of the impact that we have on people. That's what
right.
Frank's always saying.
That's right.
We are T H. Oh, we thought, A, P, the New York example. It was a point where we really realized that. It was, I'm in the 80s, and we did a performance in New York at the Franklin Furnace that we thought was just, like, terrible. And one of the worst things that we had ever done. That was where A. Annie was Are you talking about that one, the Village Voice one, or are you talking about the Fred Hat one? There's like two situations, really. There's plenty of them, but you're kind of... There were two performances that we did in New York. We did a bunch of them, but there were two. One of the first ones we did in New York was where the first time we met Annie, and she was in the cast. And the rest of the cast... Before she was a performance artist, this was when she was still doing adult stuff and writing for adult magazines. And this was our first time going to New York, so it was kind of a big deal. It was like a 5-hour performance, and we were getting all local people to be in the performance. And someone who knew us and knew that we were going to be in New York was in New York like months before and at a party and spotted Annie. But this is before anybody knew who Annie was and thought, ah, Frank would like her. So went up to her and told her about this artist that's coming from Berkeley, and Annie was kind of like this until they said Frank's name. And she had read an article about Frank in High Performance magazine and had really been attracted to him, and she got excited. And we were the same thing. This person called from New York and said, oh, I found somebody for you, and we're going to kind of, oh, great, you know. And then she told us it's Annie, and we had read Richard Schechner from NYU had taken his class to a striptease place, and Annie was one of the performers, and so he wrote about her in his magazine, The Drama Review, and Frank had read that and been, ah, she's the one I want to meet. So it was like a mutual thing. But then in the months that led up to us being in New York, there was a lot of phone calls, and she was mailing us all the stuff, you know, all her magazines and her writings and stuff, and insisting that we stay with her when we're in New York.
Oh.
And we didn't want to. Because, I mean, in some ways we were we're pretty straight in some ways, you know, and we pictured like orgies and drugs, and it's like, and but she was really insistent. And we were having a hard time getting out of it. And then she sent us a poem, Ellen Annie, where she describes Ellen, who's this fat Jewish girl, who's what's Annie's real name. And then Annie, who's this sexy, flamboyant woman. So the next time we were on the phone with her, Frank said, we'll stay with Ellen. And somehow that all worked.
Wow.
Then we get to New York. And we had invited two people that had been in the similar performance in L.A., thinking that there would at least be two people that had worked with us, because you have this whole cast of people that were meeting 3 days before the performance with this, like, 30-page script. Well, we get there, and it took us a couple days to figure out that the two L.A. people wouldn't talk to Annie, because they thought that they were above being in a cast with a porn star.
Oh.
And Annie was, like, used to this. This is just, like, normal to her. And we were, like, so we're staying at Annie's, and, like, after 2 days of rehearsal or something, we're back at Annie's. I'm in tears, you know. It's just so horrible. And I said, why are we doing this performance if it's about people being one and our cast isn't even talking to each other? And I was just, like, you know, I didn't want to do it. And so Frank goes back the next day for the rehearsals, and he's like, he's like this, and he tells Annie and the woman from L.A., Shelley. Now, what Shelley would do, like, things would happen, like, you know, Annie's making her money writing for adult magazines. And so she's really, like, you know, she's going around to everybody and saying she'd like to take some photographs, and but she needs to get release forms, and would it be okay with them? And, you know, Shelley and the guy were like, you know, how, of course you'd be doing something like that. It was just, like, so demeaning to them to even be talking about the art in that context. But when it was, like, part of the performance, they would interact with her. So Frank says, Shelley and Annie go into the cave, because we had this, like, cave thing constructed, and arrow play with each other, which is Frank's word, physical play between adults that has no limits but isn't sex. Mm-hmm. And she would do that, you know, because that was part of the instruction. So she's somebody she won't talk to or have anything to do with. She's playing erotically with for like an hour in this cave. And then meanwhile, he had everybody else lay down and close their eyes. And he did this kind of mind trip thing where he created the feeling that the performance should have. Uh-huh. And at the end of it, he said, this is the feeling I'm going for. He said, I'm canceling tomorrow's rehearsal, which was like the only rehearsal left. And there was really like this 30-page script. He said, if the performance is a flop, I'm the only name they're going to know, and I don't care. He said, I just want you to focus on this feeling. Don't worry about the script. Just focus on this feeling. That's all I care about. And we did the performance, and, I mean, in our minds, we could feel that it was still, I mean, they still didn't talk to Annie, you know, and it just created a really creepy feeling. And that's the one that we got written up in the Village Voice and got this great review. And it's like, oh, you know, well, maybe people don't notice that. You know, maybe the work is strong enough that it kind of transcends
and you
stuff
also,
like that.
I mean, you had to have made some, you know, you had to get through a few of those cracks in the wall.
Right.
Between
right.
them.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was a great decision to just cancel the rehearsal. It reminds me of the one poem on your website called Art is a Bitch.
Uh-huh.
You know? It's like when you just go and you say, you know, it's the doing of the art that is important. And mm-hmm. to make the art, you know, I have to do the art. And whatever it takes to do the art. You know, whether the audience, you know, walks out on it or whatever, that's not what's important.
Yes.
It's to do the art. And you obviously sensed that to do this piece of art, you were going to have to give people that day off to just sit with what this was supposed to be about. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other time that I thought he was talking about was another New York performance where this time we had our cast and there was a whole bunch of us that went to New York, and the one woman that was in the cast completely fell apart. It was like her school friends showed up, and all of a sudden she was like, you know, doubting everything about her current life and just all this shit. And so it was just really a rough trip. I think we did like 2 weekends or something, and it was just hell. I mean, after the performance, we'd go to these all-night dives, and we'd just be like, plowing through all this shit with her. And, you know. And then years later, this New York artist emails Frank. Then years go by, and then there's the internet. And this guy just finds Frank on the internet, says he was at one of those performances. He's an artist. And he was at a transition point and not knowing where to go. And the experience of being at that performance opened everything up for him, and everything fell into place. It was stuff that was already there, but it was it just kind of made it all happen.
It created the window, the door that he needed.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, see, that's what I mean.
You don't know.
We don't know. All we can do is do our truth and just trust that it's going to affect some and they'll get what they need.
H-E-Hey-It. There. M. U. There must be a E. A. Easy. Easier way to get S. E. X. Sex.
Frank, now I heard you were a virgin. I heard you were a virgin, so, you know, don't give me any of that.
That was A. L. Al Goldstein that said that. That was during the Outrageous Beauty review. That was part of the shtick.
Oh, that,
you know,
that must be an easier way to get to have sex.
Oh, no, that Frank was a virgin.
Oh, that Frank was a virgin?
No. What did Al Goldstein say? That you do it? He is a virgin. Oh, Al Goldstein said that he was a virgin. Right. That's
well,
right.
Well, the other day I called Frank the Howard Stern of the disability rights movement. So, so he's just spoofing on me for that.
No. In. Your. I N in your interview, the barrier free. That's where you said,
right.
Do you do art just to have sex?
Do you do art just to have sex? Yep. Yeah, you're spoofing on that one. Yeah. I know it.
L O lob C A called me the K I N king of all media. And that's the same thing as Stern. Before Howard Stern was calling himself right the king of all media. Lob, well, who is an artist.
Yeah. I have to tell you about the interview that I did a few years ago, the Barrier Free. I really had fun with that one because I came in and it's like I am extremely liberal minded, and I had fun coming in and playing the role of the journalist that's going to ask the pointed questions that, you know, the confrontational, you know, but don't you just do your art so that you can have sex? I had a lot of fun playing that.
All M O almost, no, M O S T most are reporters did that one right.
That's what I figured. I figured I can't remember what question it was I asked you, but you had it was great. Your answer was, aren't they the same thing? I can't remember what the question was. I asked you something and you said, aren't they the same thing? And it just cracked me up. I can't remember what it was, though.
I don't remember either.
You don't remember, huh?
Yeah.
It was supposedly one of those, you know, would you call yourself a this or would you call yourself a that? And you answered, well, aren't they the same thing?
What? When? F R E A freak out. There's that. I don't know if they hit you up to be on their show. It was freak out. It was a BBC thing. Oh yeah, Channel 4, but in England. And they did a TV series about disability and like edgy stuff. And so they sent their crew here. This was, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5.
No, I was on a show but it was called Desirability.
No, this is a different one.
And it was on Channel 4. So
yeah.
You sure it wasn't the same one?
It wasn't, but I hear that Channel 4 is the channel. Has all the good stuff. But what about them? So they send their crew here. Oh, about the questions? Oh, right.
Oh, so they actually interviewed you.
Yeah, well, it was a guy, the producer, we actually never met. Him and Frank had a long, you know, pre-interview relationship.
That was definitely a different one because the producer of the show, mine, was actually a woman with a disability. So, yeah, so that would have been a different group than the one I worked with.
And so then the crew, right before they show up, like a day before or something, he sends Frank a list of questions and answers. And he said, these are the questions
answers?
That they're going to ask you, and these are your answers. Say what? So needless to say, we were ready when that crew showed up. The crew was great, you know, and so it turned into really Frank trashing this guy. That was like the whole interview.
Yeah.
Because he right away tells everybody, this is what they told me and this is what I'm not doing. You know. But they H I are hired a actress to God. I completely forgot about that. Frank talked them into, because they wanted an example of, you know, what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Can't, maybe. I do a art for sex, after all. Now that you think about it. So he got them to pay, but he got them to pay someone to, you know, do whatever Frank came up with as an example of his art. But not be E, very E, R. Didn't turn out to be very erotic.
Well, yeah. was she very, you know, free and loose, or she was
no.
Probably, yeah. Well, no. Then
the money thing really can screw things up, you know, because people that will do things for money aren't really often that great.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, so. Yeah. Yeah, no, the attitude that she would have come in with had to be more.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Did they ever air any of it? Do you know?
Did they use any of that footage? Not the part with the woman? Did they use any of that footage? The part with the actress? No, I didn't
did
think
they
so.
How about
they
your
aired art. They did it. Actually, did the segment was pretty okay. Mm. Weren't we happy with the segment? In a way? Yeah. It wasn't one of the best things. The director and the crew were great.
Did they have any disability awareness? Were they people with disabilities at all? Or
yes. But it was kind of like an exploitation, uh-huh. kind of National Enquirer
well,
type
sometimes
program.
The BBC is kind of that way. I mean, yeah. they always try to find the edge, you know, what was the, you
yeah.
know. And they have to build a drama. They try to build a drama in,
yes.
in a lot of their stuff.
S-H-A, shallow, S-H, sham. Oh, sham or shaman. That's how it started out. Shaman or sham? You decide. You be the judge. Actually, it was uphill after that, I seem to remember. Once that was over, it actually was okay. It was, you know.
Did you ever go, you know, they have the BBC has a website. I'm blanking on the name of it, but it's where all the disabled people in at the BBC write notes on what they think about the shows. Did you ever, have you ever, no, I'll have to send you the link and you can go and see if any people, local people, ouch, yeah, that's it, ouch.
O-U-C-H.
O-U-C-H, ouch, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
They, I, N, interviewed, A, C, R, I, a crip, H, I, S, T, oh, historian, right. This on for Frank's segment. They interviewed a bunch of people. Annie was one of the people they interviewed, and Dirk Dirksen from the Outrageous Beauty Review days. And this historian, this disability historian, I, A, C, T, actually, D, I, R, directed, N, O, R, normal people. That's what the historian talked in terms of, that Frank actually, as a director, directed normal people.
Did they interview any people that have actually though been, you know, at your events, or any people that have worked with you?
Annie.
Well,
Annie
but
and Dirk.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Those are names.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
we gave them a whole list of people, but they went for the name names.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. A lot of the people we thought would have been great for.
Because I'm
interview.
Thinking of the guy, like you said, you got
right,
the email
Fred.
From.
Yeah.
That said.
Which we probably gave them his name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to say sham or shaman, yeah. shaman, you know, yeah. then you should ask the people that have been affected
right.
by your work, you
right.
know.
It wasn't that kind
Not
of show.
That,
Why did they C.O. come from England to interview you if you're a sham? What? Who is the fool?
Good point.
S I so don't no S I no S S O S S I don't L E let us E earn money.
There's ways that you can do it totally legal. If you file self-employment taxes for one thing and keep all your expenses and your expenses, you know, come to quite a lot, you know, plus you can do things for what's called earwees for expenses like paying somebody to assist you, you like your attendant work, that counts as an expense. So there's ways that you can write off enough that you can still keep your SSI and be an artist.
I
and make money.
S T A started a church. That's the way Frank got around it in the 70s.
Well, I remember that, but I didn't realize that was actually that you'd actually registered that as a church.
We had to fight the IRS. We had the ACLU represent us. We had to fly to DC. This is all in the 70s because we were turned down originally because we didn't believe in God. And so the ACLU made this case based on Frank's writings that we believe in the God who is in every person, and made a case for that, and we got it. So we got the tax exempt
status.
Well, that's
great, because that's probably opened the doors for lots of different religious groups, you know. I mean, that's a neat president. Yeah.
Yeah. I did not do it for the M.O. money. S.H.E. shelter. But we kind of discovered that would be, because anything that we do that's art-related goes to the church. And then the church pays for the art.
I was going to say, because you have expenses that you got to meet, so there has to be a flow of money from somewhere.
Yes.
And
but Frank individually has nothing to do with any of it.
Right.
So
right.
None of the money ever goes to him. If he ever does anything, he has the check made out to Interrelations. So
okay.
He never has anything to do with the money. Very good. He sometimes
good.
Says he thinks that was the smartest thing he's
That's
ever done.
Very good. Yeah, very good. You got my wheels spinning now.
Can see that. R E A L really We. S. U. P. Support. The art. Yeah, because it barely breaks even.
And you know, I know you're like me. You do it because you have to. It's something that is what you've been put here to let flow through you. And, you know, I mean, my book, I published it myself, you know. I mean, I paid for the printing. I paid for it. I'll probably never clear the expenses, but it's like I had to do it because nobody else was talking about these artists that I talk about in my book. And nobody else was telling these stories. And I had them in my head, and I had the ability to pull enough resources together to, you know, use my credit card and go in debt on it. But I felt, you know, I was driven. I was driven. It had to happen, and I did it because I did it for the art. I didn't do it for the money. You know, like I say, I'll probably never clear expenses, but that's not why we do it. That's not why we do it.
That's right. But S-S-I don't understand that.
Well, no. They
that they S-E-C M money coming in. And
well,
they,
You know, it goes even deeper than SSI. Our whole country is built on this work ethic that we have to work 40 hours a week, and people have been trained that they have to do that, and that's what being a good American is. And the reason that's been perpetuated is because that way you keep people buying products, and then you keep people working to make the products. And we've passed the point where we need to do that, because we don't need, you know, we don't have enough jobs to go around. So why do people need to work 40 hours a week? But the whole systems, the SSI systems and everything, are based on that philosophy that work is a 40-hour week thing that you do, and you either can do it or you can't do it. And if you're doing it part-time, well, then they can't get that. They can't understand that. Or if you're doing something that isn't exactly work, but sometimes you make money at it, they can't understand it, because they understand either you work or you don't work. And if you work, it's 40 hours a week, and rah-rah, you're a good American, you know? I mean, it's all part of that whole system of when they had to encourage people to work hard because they needed people to work. We don't need people to work that hard anymore. People can play. Do work that's play.
Yes. That is very V-A-L. That is valuable.
Yeah, definitely. And that may sound like a contradiction to what I said earlier, which is that growing up in Nebraska, I learned a good work ethic. But it's different, because by a work ethic, I mean, when I went on SSI, one of the things that was really hard was I felt like, you know, I'm no longer working. I'm not worth anything. I'm supposed to work. And then I said, no, wait a minute. I volunteer here and here and here. I do this. I'm helping teach this Vietnamese family English. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And I said, I work. It's just that I'm not working at a 40-hour a job week. And I found out that what SSI did, going on SSI did, is it gave me the freedom to work where I knew I was most needed and where I knew I was best.
H. E. Hell. L. Helms. O. Opened. O. P. No, P. I picked the wrong artist, wrong A, G, E, N, agency, Helms picked the wrong he should be going after SSI. That's yes. what Frank always says. Most of the artists we know get supported by SSI, not the NEA.
Not the NEA.
I did not have a NEA grant when Helms was investigating.
Oh, you didn't have, did I say you had a grant? I think I said you had
a grant. Yeah, yeah. Frank had gotten one NEA grant before that.
And so he was.
But at the point he was investigated, we were back to just paying for our own stuff.
Ah.
But it seemed like the way he got it was that a lot of the spaces that would perform, would book somebody like Frank did get money from the government depended on the government money to open up money for from other places. So most of them then didn't want to book people that were being investigated.
I see. Okay, that makes sense.
But they were not B-O-O. They weren't booking Frank anyway. You know, I mean, the alternative art spaces never would book Frank.
No?
No. So it was like we had nothing to lose. You know, there was nothing they could take away from us. We weren't getting NEA money. We weren't getting booked by spaces that got money.
I know. As I've been an artist, I've had to be careful about how I build myself at different things because I have done work as a consultant for the NEA, and I've done work that I felt was important work because it was work trying to increase opportunities for artists with disabilities. And I've served on grants panels, and I've felt it's been important to do that, to have a person with a disability decide. Because, for example, there's a lot of people who write grants that are not disabled, know nothing about disability, but they're wanting to do a project about disability. And I'm on that grant panel. I'm going to point out the holes in that proposal. So it was important for me to, you know, portray myself in this one way for the NEA. But meanwhile, I'm doing some stuff on stages and in my own art that, you know, is. I've always been careful about how I've presented myself, and my resumes have been doctored a little bit differently depending on where it's going.
What is your favorite FALFAK fake? What is your fake NA name?
Which one? Lady Pamela. That's not real fake, but
H E Hey. I don't think H E Helms even knew I was disabled.
Really?
You know, what we heard was that there was an article in a Washington newspaper, Washington, D.C. newspaper, Mooney. It's a Mooney newspaper. And they had done, they had sent reporters to Franklin Furnace, but the Franklin Furnace people didn't know much, but they asked access to the archives, which Franklin Furnace was like, that was part of their thing, having archives. So they wrote an article based on their research in Franklin Furnace's archives. And it looked like what they did was they just, like Frank's scripts were all part of the archives because he had performed there. They just like looked for anything that had to do with erotic, sexual. Then they write this article. They had like five or six people they talked about, Frank being one of them, that did obscene art. And what we were told, and what we read about, like in the LA Times and stuff, was that that's what Helms based it on, was that article. So we don't really think he knew anything about Frank, that
I'll
he
bet.
Knew that Frank
I'll
was disabled.
Right.
And our fantasy was that we'd have an opportunity to wheel Frank into the Senate, you know, and You know, have everybody go through those changes when they see who this Frank Moore is that Jesse Helms is investigating.
This Frank Moore that he is so terrified is corrupting our youth. Yes.
Right. So we're out of time.
Oh, that went fast.
It always does go fast. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could, should do it again.
We'll see. I'm moving to Davis at the end of the month.
Right.
And so
after you're like completely situated.
Once I'm settled in Davis.
You can T A talk about D.A. Dave DeWeird?
Davis.
Oh, Davis. Sorry. You could talk about Davis and what Davis is like.
Yes, what I'm finding there. It's a very exciting thing because I haven't let myself really fantasize or get any preconceived notions of what my life there is going to be like. I'm just going to go there and let Davis come to me and find out what my life happens. There's a lot of opportunities, you know, in theater and different things, but I'm just going to wait and kind of see what happens. Yeah.
We will P L play the your videos on the SHO on the show before this interview. This will be on BTV.
Okay,
on
great.
On Frank's show, we'll play your videos. So that when people see this interview, they'll be familiar with your work.
Great. I brought four videos, and I'm pleased to have them have a life beyond the video box. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Pamela K. Walker.
Thank you.
Get her book. It's real
book.
Good. Moving Over the Edge. Artists with Disabilities Take the Leap.
Including, it's worth it just for the before and after pictures on the back.
And there'll be a link to the website where you can get this in the archives of Pamela's show tonight. Okay, good night.
Good night.